This is episode 393. We're in an era where the internet celebrates on mass scale the tragedy of other people, and it's severely damaging to the mental and physical health of not only those on the screen, but I believe those watching as well. Now, on this episode, I talk with a clinical psychologist and eating disorder expert about how ADD and ADHD leads to emotional eating and eating disorders. And we also discuss the complex and often tragic internet overeating trend known as mukbang. We also go to the other end of the spectrum and discuss famous anorexic influencers and where the responsibility lies within these social media platforms that allow these often terribly unhealthy and sad situations to flourish. This episode is full of lots of very interesting twists, turns, and triggering topics. But towards the end, we also give you a place to start to fix your own eating challenges. So let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome to the show, where the mission of this podcast is to create a world where everyone is someone's healthy friend. And every single episode will help you with the tools and the advice and the information for you to become the healthiest, happiest, and most evolved version of yourself so that you can live an abundantly healthy life. Now, you're dropping in here with me, obviously, and clinical psychologist Stephanie Giorgio. Now, Steph is not only a psychologist, but also a corporate speaker and is TikTok famous with several million views on her content. But most importantly, before all of that, she was an OG on this podcast. She was first on episode 14. That's right, 14. And also episode 65. And then 4 years happened, and now we're back on to continue a conversation today that we haven't had in a long time. So Steph, welcome back to the show.
Maddie, thank you so much for having me back on the show. It's an honor to be back 4 years later. Well done. I'm being so consistent with this podcast.
It's a labor of love, but I get to hang out with cool people like you.
That is true. It's been a minute, so I'm excited to catch up and really touch on some important topics.
Before we jump into it though, you also have a podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about that and where people can find it?
Yes, it's called the What's Eating You podcast. I designed it because obviously TikTok is short form content, and I wanted a space to be able to break down complex mental health topics, dilemmas, questions that people submit around psychology, and you can find it wherever you download your podcasts.
Amazing. And I'll put some links down below in the show notes and the caption for that. So anybody that wants to go check it out, obviously wait till you finish this episode, then go check out Steph's show. It's awesome. I literally listened to 3 episodes today, but I noticed, you know, because you and I, we sort of bounce off one another with like, we chat for a little while and then we go and do our own thing for a few months and then we come back together. And I've been, you know, observing your world and listening to your podcast, and you talk a lot these days about ADD and ADHD. And I remember back in the day, and if anybody goes and listens to episode 14, they'll go back to the Melbourne Brunch Queen days. So you started off as the Melbourne Brunch Queen or the Mel Brunch Queen. And I was lucky enough to come along to some of those brunches. But that was kind of the entry point for you to sort of bridge this gap in a really socially acceptable way to talk about food and sugar and our attachment to it. And that's kind of led now to the ADD, ADHD conversation in the context of food. So all of that to preface the question, how did you go from being the Mel Brunch Queen to now being the ADHD and eating disorder psychologist?
That is such a good question. And I honestly just believe things happen for a reason and things fall together. And obviously we went out for that brunch before the world shut down. And when the world shut down, I couldn't go to cafes anymore. So I decided to pivot my brunch page towards a psychology page. And then over those lockdowns, people were struggling with their relationship with food and people discovered they had undiagnosed ADHD, particularly women. So I really started putting content out on TikTok about binge eating, the link between ADHD and eating disorders, and people have never resonated enough because it's not something that is spoken about a lot. So yeah, the pivot has been really good. I still do a lot of food content. I mean, I moved to the Gold Coast as well, so couldn't be the Melbourne Brunch Queen. And I guess the blogger scene, it's not that big over here, but let me tell you, when you have to pay for food, my God. It adds up.
Yeah, that was one of the best parts of going out with you is that we get the entire menu for free.
Literally, I loved those good old days.
Yeah, amazing. And you mentioned sort of going into lockdowns, which is obviously anyone that was in Melbourne, it was an awful time and for anybody anywhere, but that's where I'm from. Melbourne was particularly bad. But you said that people started resonating with this ADD, ADHD idea. Do you think that was previously undiagnosed, or that lockdown trapped in a cell in your own house was the thing that triggered it or unearthed it in most people's situation because they'd never been in a situation like that before?
Definitely unearthed it or unmasked it. So basically, we weren't with our usual distractions. We weren't going to the office. We didn't have our friends. And women in particular, and men, but I think for women, they really noticed their struggles a lot more. Things such as managing the household and working from home, being distracted, being unable to look after the kids, disorganization, which previously they just sort of put down to their personality or, you know, their character. Oh, I'm just a messy person. But yes, being stuck at home, they were stuck with their difficulties. I think those lockdowns really caused us to look inward and be with our feelings. We couldn't escape. We couldn't go out and drink. We couldn't go to the gym. So we really had to just sit with our issues. And for many people, they realized a lot of them were issues with concentration, focus, attention, organization, and planning.
And do you think that unearthing or unmasking of that symptomology that came from that weird, bizarre time in our history, do you think that once we got back to normal, whatever normal means, because a lot permanently changed, at least here in Melbourne, but do you think people were able to go back to their normal lives and let go of these sort of ADD, ADHD tendencies that kind of came out given the situation? Or do you feel like people were sort of permanently damaged and or changed by that experience?
I think it depends on the individual. If they understood it and got help and were medicated or found strategies for themselves, I think there was a lot more compassion, acceptance, and being able to manage the symptoms of what's going on. But I think for people who were just shoved back into that hustle culture, into the go, 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 I think adjusting to that change would have been really challenging, because change is challenging for people who are neurodiverse. But I think people just got used to it, got used to being at home or got used to being in a particular routine. And then to have to go back from, you know, putting your foot right down on the gas pedal, that's such an extreme change. I don't know, even I felt challenging going from what we were doing to going, like what you said, back to normal. So I can't imagine it not being difficult for someone who was neurodiverse and was just figuring that out.
Yeah. Oh, it was, I felt like a mess during lockdowns. But I know for myself, and I've kind of always, loosely speaking, had, you know, easily distracted, trouble focusing. And it's taken a long time to train myself to be different. And every report card when I was a kid was sort of like, oh, you know, has a lot of potential, but easily distracted. That's like the story of my childhood and my school years. But, and maybe this is controversial and maybe you disagree, which is totally okay, but it feels like these days it's a symptom of the millennial generation of social media addiction, sugar addiction and porn addiction and insert any other addiction that is resulting in a behavior set or a brain functioning system that looks like ADD and ADHD because the system that we are in creates a brain that looks like that. Not because anybody's inherently, not anybody, but not because most of us are inherently flawed, but the system breaks us, like creates the ADD brain.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I definitely think we have ADHD traits without having ADHD. And I think society has made us that way. You know, there's times where I think, oh my gosh, do I have it? You know, but it's the level of impairment at the end of the day. And it's dependent on how long these symptoms have been present. So if, for example, for the last 4 years, you're like, I can't concentrate, I can't focus, I'm addicted to my phone. Yes, societally induced ADHD symptoms, I think, is a phenomenon. But if it's not impairing your life on a day-to-day basis, if it hasn't been present in your childhood, if it's not occurring across contexts, that it's not clinically diagnosed ADHD, because you have to be able to prove that these symptoms have been with you since your childhood. You know, the belief is you are born with it. You are born with a different wired brain. But I don't disagree with you. I do think society and technology and all the dopamine we have access to is stuffing up our brains. It is causing attention deficits. It is causing addiction. And I'm guilty for it too. You know, I'm addicted to my phone. And I know. Yeah. And like you said, we have to be so disciplined in this day and age to get anything done. But just because you struggle with this, it doesn't mean you have clinically diagnosed ADHD.
Yeah. Well, we were talking before we hit record about even being business owners and having podcasts and doing all of these things that from the outside make us look hyper productive, that, you know, behind the scenes, we even kind of feel the same, is that motivation's hard and distraction's hard. And when you've got a business that functions through social media, you might pick up your phone to be like, I'm in work mode, I've got to do this thing. And then 2 hours later, be like, why did I come here again?
Yes, yes, exactly. And then you get frustrated at yourself. And I think the difference as well is people with ADHD have a very high, strong inner critic that's always been with them. You know, why can't you just do this? Or you always get distracted. You don't stick to anything. What's wrong with you? You're lazy, all that. Whereas I think people who are neurotypical can be a little bit more forgiving and, you know, look past things, and they haven't received that messaging their whole life about, you know, what's wrong with you, or why can't you be like other people, and all of that. But yeah, I mean, do you know that you don't have it?
No idea. I remember getting tested when I was really little, like as in 4 years old, 5 years old. I remember going and getting some tests, and we also went to a naturopath. Sort of mum always did both kind of sides of the modalities, and mum's a nurse. And I have a white ring around my eye, which is not related to a nutritional deficiency. It's been there from birth, still there. And the naturopath said that that was the reason that I was just super energetic and like bouncing off the walls all of the time. And not much has changed, to be honest. Yeah, I was four. I don't really remember it clearly. I probably need to chat to mum to get the download. But yeah, I mean, I feel very resistant to going and getting any kind of inspection. And the reason for that is that I feel like it's the snowflake's way out of doing hard work. That's my honest opinion for myself. And so I don't want to go and get an excuse for my lack of, because whether I've got it or not, I'm still working in this world. I've still got to operate in this world. I've still got to succeed in this world. So I don't want a ticket to say, oh, that's all right, you don't have to work today.
Yeah. And I get it. Some people, some people do think that getting a label might make them lazy, or they might use it to their advantage or justify. But the way I see it is like this. It's like an eyesight condition. Right? If you need glasses, you can be like, no, do you know what? I'm going to squint and do this without my glasses. I can do it. Or you put the freaking glasses on, you take the medication, and you can see so much better and get it done. So look, it's people really have this thing about medication, some people, but ADHD medication is really different to antidepressant, anxiety medication. You take it when you need it. You don't have to take it every day. And this is not psychiatric advice. Always speak to your psychiatrist, disclaimer. It's something that helps your brain. It's like caffeine. So for some people, they do need it to function. But if you've learned strategies where, you know, you don't need it, then that's amazing. If you don't need it, you don't need it. If you don't want to get diagnosed, don't get diagnosed. I think it's great if people think they have it, but they've learned a way to live with it, then let it affect them.
Yeah. And I know that, I guess we started with like the food conversation. So how does this tie into the food conversation? Because that's very much the world that I work in as well, right? With emotional eating and, you know, all of these different challenges with people, you know, are addicted to sugar or can't put the thing down even though they know that they should. So how does that impact, I guess, people's relationship with food?
Oh, so let's just break down. ADHD, it's a neurodevelopmental condition, just meaning that your brain didn't develop in the typical way. And the understanding is that you have lower levels to important neurotransmitters such as dopamine and norepinephrine, right? Really important. Reward seeking, feeling good, and norepinephrine is initiation, getting things done. Now, when you have lower levels of dopamine in your brain, you're going to be looking for that in places. And food is the easiest, most accessible, socially acceptable way to get dopamine. So that's one of the reasons, is the dopamine hypothesis. The second reason is living a life of ADHD or even undiagnosed ADHD is stressful. You're constantly in a dysregulated nervous system, fight or flight. And when you're in that state, a lot of people go to food to self-soothe, to avoid difficult emotions and feelings, distraction, all the things that you know it. And the other thing is just negative thoughts, feelings we want to distract ourselves from. You know, if you get an email from your boss and you're like, oh my God, they want a meeting, I've done something wrong. We know that people with ADHD have rejection sensitive dysphoria, which is a sensitivity to perceived rejection. That can set them off where they want to eat to self-soothe. And I mean, you know, Maddie, we grow up being taught to self-soothe with food. Don't cry, have a lollipop. Or, you know, you've been such a good girl, have a jelly bean. So ADHD and just learning to self-soothe with food growing up, there's such a strong link with it. Oh, and people with ADHD forget to eat, so they're more prone to binge eating later.
Yeah, makes sense. And I think as well, and we sort of touched on this before as you were sharing, you know, I think it's actually the minority of people that grow up in a home around healthy, well-adjusted parents that know how to manage conflict and emotional triggers and, you know, and manage chaos in a way that teaches all of us how to not go towards food or drugs or porn or Netflix or insert doom scroll, whatever, you know. And so I guess, and it goes back to that idea of, you know, the system, and the system might be, you know, the nuclear family that of people that didn't learn from their parents to be able to do the things. So I guess that puts us all in this group of susceptibility to, you know, these dopamine seeking behaviors.
Absolutely. And look, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, in moderation, we all do it, but I think it really comes down to how do we feel out of it? How do we feel after we eat? How do we feel when we're eating? Is there guilt? Is there shame? Do people know their fullness and hunger cues? So if you've got this history of dieting and yo-yo behavior, then you're going to be even more at risk of developing disordered eating or eating disorders as you know it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed an episode of yours, your podcast, when I was listening today, where you were talking about when somebody comments on what you're eating, if it's cake or sugar or whatever, about just fully owning it and just being like, hell yeah, I am. And it's amazing, rather than having that shame narrative come up and be like, oh yeah, I know, but you know, I'm going to go to the gym later and justify your behavior. And yeah. I really liked that because we, like you said, it's not bad. We all go towards it. You know, we all enjoy it from time to time, and the ratio or frequency that you do that with is totally up to you. But then it comes back to that idea of at what point does it become go from being helpful to being harmful?
Exactly. And I think the biggest misconception is people think, you know, I need to not crave chocolate. I need to get rid of cravings, or I need to just only eat 2 bites. But in order to get to that phase, you have to give yourself unconditional permission to eat all the foods. And we call this the food honeymoon phase in food freedom, where eat whatever you want, whenever you want, but people can decide how much they eat as long as they eat within a structure, because it's the structure of how people eat that affects them, not so much the quantities, etc. So yes, you have to give yourself full permission to eat the cake, and you might go overboard, but eventually your body is going to get to a point where it's like, you know what, I feel like some salad today.
I love those cravings for salad. And then when you get the fresh food into your face and you're like, oh, why don't I eat this for every meal? This is so good.
Yeah, because life would be boring if we never, you know, indulged those parts of ourselves or ate for reasons other than hunger. There's this, you know, whole movement that food is fuel and you should only eat when you're hungry and stop eating when you're full. But there's psychological hunger. There are reasons, you know, that you eat when you may not be particularly hungry. No one wakes up saying, oh, I really crave birthday cake today. But when you're at a birthday, you have a piece of cake.
Yeah, it's part of that cultural, you know, and social cohesiveness of like enjoying the experience and enjoying the milestone and being present in the group of which you identify that you belong, right?
Yes, food is an experience. And I think people have lost touch with that, and they think they have to be super restrictive in order to be happy, because society teaches you that, or shows you that thinness and happiness are one in the same. And we just assume that thinness and happiness go together.
Yeah, that's good. I reckon a lot of people can resonate with that because the whole weight loss narrative is always a part of the conversation. Even if, no matter if you're in the health industry anywhere, basically, the weight loss is maybe 90% of the time, it's a part of the conversation, definitely in my world. And even for people that I would deem, and it's not up to me to make the judgment, but that I would deem at a healthy weight, they're strong, probably got good muscle mass, but it's this food noise in their head about getting skinnier and skinnier. And I guess that's where you eventually end in a conversation of eating disorders, right? Of, you know, you end up at a place where people are trying to get skinnier and skinnier to the point that they're orthorexic or they're anorexic. And it's, you know, it's becoming a real risk to their health.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, like, what is a healthy size? Do you know what I mean? When I ask people, what's your idea of health? What does health mean to you versus weight loss? Because losing weight is not necessarily healthy. And weight isn't an indicator of health. Do you know what I mean? There are people who have a preference to lose weight or a preference to be in a smaller body, but because they're not, it doesn't mean that they're medically compromised or health compromised in some way. It's a preference. And I think people don't realize that.
I've got a question for you. Where does the healthy at every size scenario become celebrating obesity and unhealthy bodies?
This is the thing. I really think it's a case-by-case approach because when you see people online, when you see women in larger bodies promoting body positivity, I think it's great. I think it's amazing, but they do get a lot of hate. Like, you're promoting obesity. We don't know what these people do day to day. We don't know how they eat day to day. We don't know if they have medical or health problems. We don't know if they're happy. We don't know if they're not happy. So I really think it comes down to you, and it really comes down to asking those challenging questions with yourself. Like, there are women who I know are happy and they live fulfilling lives and they eat out with their families, but deep down, like, oh, I really have this preference to lose weight. And you've got to have that serious conversation. Are you prepared to be in a calorie deficit? Are you prepared to be tired all the time? Are you prepared to sacrifice family with your friends? And then once you get to your goal weight, are you prepared to then do things to maintain it? Because the weight, it's not that people think it's a destination, but if you want to lose weight and keep it off, you have to adhere to a consistently rigid lifestyle to keep that weight off. And I think that's what people don't realize, because dieting is the biggest predictor of weight gain in the future.
Yeah, just like hunger is the biggest predictor of emotional or binge eating, right? And that they go hand in hand, is that it's, if you're dieting, you're probably hungry. And some of your binges are actually just seeking nutrition and calories to get into the system because you're undernourished.
Mum, mother, grandmother, nan, nana, and women with no kids. Have I got your attention? So I want you to imagine something. Go with me here. Imagine a life where even when you wake up tired and the kids are driving you mad and work sucks and things are problematic, that you're still in control of your food and you still make healthy choices without giving up and binging on chocolate and wine and saying, I'll try again tomorrow. It might be hard to imagine, but having freedom with your food is absolutely possible. And it starts by getting three things right. One, having a supportive community, building a strong connection with fellow emotional eating warriors. Two, having the right information delivered in the right way. And three, having a guide that can shine a light on the right path and have your back along the way. And that's me. Those three things are exactly what we've got for you inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group for people just like you wanting to end their emotional eating and feel good in their own skin again. And currently, it's free to join. The link is in the show notes below. If you've struggled with diets or felt powerless around food, you're not alone. But let me assure you, this is a community that understands your battles and is ready to empower you into action. So what can you expect on the inside? Well, we have posts and content that push you a little out of your comfort zone. We do Facebook Lives, have interactive Q&A session, and it's simply a safe space to face your food challenges and be honest without concern of being judged. If you decide to join us, I have a complimentary How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook for you as well, completely free. The Healthy Mums Collective thrives on support, authenticity, and experience-based practices. It's a community, so the beautiful people in it is where the magic comes from. To join us and be a part of that magic, head to the show notes, click the link, breeze through a few quick questions, and you'll be in the Healthy Mums Collective before you know it. Again, the link is in the show notes below. I'll see you in the DMs or on the welcome post in just a few moments.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And to go back to your question, look, celebrating obesity, I mean, what do you think? Do you think people celebrate obesity, or are they just happy in the skin they're in? And they're like, do you know what? This is what I'm going to do. I exercise, I eat well, but I happen to be in a large body.
I think the things that you just added reframe it differently, which is that I eat well and I exercise, right? So I think what I'm talking about is the people that have massive followings online. And this is one of the issues with social media and Netflix and YouTube is that people build their identity, their income, and a range of other factors of their life around who and what they are. And this is dreadful for kids too, because you've got kids that are famous at 14 on social media that are now probably going to be locked into that version of their personality for decades longer than they normally would be, because it serves such a validating purpose. And so if we take that to the 40-year-old obese woman that's, you know, and there's that whole movement on online called mukbang, where people
they
just sit and watch people eat 10,000 calories. And, you know, there's multiple people, and I've been meaning to do an episode on the amount of people that famous people that have died that are mukbang eaters, the mukbang famous. And so that for me is like, that is championing obesity. And if I think about it on a personal level, if I met this person in the street, I'd be like, hey, what's up? How you doing? Do what you like. But also, I'm a member of society that pays tax, that has access to the healthcare system. And that person is now setting themselves up to use that healthcare system at a massively disproportionate amount to me, but we're going to pay the same tax, right? And so this is a multi-tiered issue, right? And so I think anyone that's got a following, just as you and I both have, I believe you have a responsibility. And that, you know, that's the world we're in. If thousands of people listen to this conversation, I have a responsibility to do what I believe is right, not what I believe is just going to make me money. Which in theory is what those people are going for. Either money, and they might be making zero money, but it's validating their fame and all the very deep insecurities that I believe that they probably have being in that body and destructively destroying themselves with everything and all these calories that they put in their face. Rant over, off the soapbox, back to you.
No, I need to get this off my chest too, because I am guilty of watching these mukbangs, especially on TikTok. Every second video is people eating cookies. And there are people who do this in many weights, body shapes, and sizes, right? So let's start on the far end of the spectrum. I've seen there's a very popular influencer, and he started as a vegan lifestyle influencer, and he was in a very small body. Now he is morbidly obese, and the videos are really disturbing. I don't know if he does it for likes or for the comments, but he's like sitting on the floor topless, like using one of those claw things to like pick up moldy food and eat it, and it looks unwell, and that really concerns me. But the amount of money these people are making, and just seeing someone go from, you know, an average body to obviously very, you know, they are eating like trays and trays of food. Like, that is just not healthy. And that stresses me out. That really stresses me out. But people watch it and people entertain it. And these people are making so much money. You just got to think, like, you know, would you do that? If you were going to make so much money, but you had to eat and eat and eat, I don't know, would people not do it? Maybe it serves a need.
Yeah, well, I think there's, you know, as you and I probably both know in a way that other people on social media don't know, is that there's lots of people with thousands or millions of followers that don't make any money, that make like almost zero, just because the validation pays any bill that they might want to ever pay emotionally, right? Is it, I'm famous, I'm popular, you know, and I should acknowledge too that there's a number of YouTubers that are visibly sickly anorexic that have millions of followers as well. And again, and I heard a psychologist, I forget who it was, ages ago, I don't know when, but talking about the function in society of reality TV was that you watch somebody else's tragedy so you don't manifest your own. And and the idea of that is that some part, you know, if we live a complete life, there's sadness, there's happiness, there's joy, there's tragedy. And if we can leverage the tragedy of somebody else, we're less likely to create it ourselves. And so that's essentially how I see what we're watching as reality TV now, just reality YouTube, reality TikTok, of these devastating situations where individuals put themselves in these states or were there because of childhood trauma, sexual abuse, whatever. But now they've found another way to make it all okay by, yeah, getting all of this money, all of this following. So it's like mukbang, super obese, super unhealthy and mentally ill, I would argue, for many of them. And then the other end of the spectrum, starving themselves anorexic, which feel like I shouldn't change because I make money like this and, you know, I've got millions of followers. And you look at the comments and some of those comments are like, how does YouTube allow you to be here? This is devastating. Somebody call her help, call her an ambulance. And, you know, every time it pops up in my feed, like my heart sinks, you know, I'm just like this poor woman, you know. But again, who am I to make any comment about anyone, you know?
Yeah. And oh my gosh, I could go on about this. Yes, there is a, on the other extreme end, we should probably put a trigger warning at the start of this episode, but there's a lady who's clearly anorexic and bulimic and people comment in the comments and she eats these huge grotesque meals, but she slices butter with every bite. Because if you are bulimic and you have like ice cream or butter or whatever, it helps the food come up easier. And she's like eating a block of butter. And I'm like, how is this allowed on the internet? But I think if this was an obese person promoting this, would it be allowed on the internet? So, oh, it's such a deep, dark wormhole. But I'm guilty of watching those videos too. Like I feel good watching those cookie videos and being like, yum, like I picked to the chocolate. And it's weird because I feel when I was doing blogging, people would love seeing me eat. And this was back in the day before mukbang was a thing, but I would post eating videos and people were like, oh my God, like why do you post eating videos or whatever? And people loved it. Like, oh my God, if she can eat a pancake and not, you know, be a certain weight or whatever, then I can eat it. So for some people, it was validating and reassuring that, you know, you can eat the foods you want to eat. But also then I felt compelled to like, okay, I need to order the pancakes. I need to order this. I need to order that. And then I would be doing it almost for other people and not for me. So yeah, it's been a whole journey, but the online eating space and the what I eat in a day is so problematic for so many reasons.
Yeah, I'm so excited this conversation went this direction because these are things I wanted to
talk about it.
Yeah, I've wanted to talk about this stuff with like, you know, people before, but it's such a strange rabbit hole and like you said, triggering, offensive. As soon as you bring up healthy at every size or this kind of stuff. Like, you know, you get a bunch of really angry people fired up, which, you know, I don't mind being controversial. I think somebody has to take the responsibility of having difficult conversations in a public setting. Mm. But yeah, I think we straddle the line, right? Because the thing we love about social media is freedom of speech, right?
Yeah.
Freedom of expression. And so then it becomes, well, if we don't let people of a certain weight on either end of the spectrum in, that's discrimination, right? So it's this is why it's such a vague gray area because where do YouTube's policies and guidelines ban an anorexic girl but not somebody else who's got some other health issue, right? And it's does that result in her ending up committing suicide because you've cut her off from her supply of validation? It was the only thing keeping her going, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think social media meets needs for people. This is why I think TikTok is therapy because you find someone who's that father figure you never had. You find someone who's eating the foods you would never eat. And I think that's why TikTok in particular, and probably YouTube, a lot of people are getting their needs met and it just stops them dealing with their own issues in the real world. But yeah, where does the responsibility lie? Is it in the content creator? Is it in the person watching? Is it with the platforms?
Yeah, that makes me think of a statistic that has been floating around for a few years now and getting worse, which is teens, 20s and 30s, people in those age groups, sex and alcohol consumption, both the lowest they've ever been. And I think that it's because, and if we add on social media, we add on porn to that, is that people have no need to go out into the real world, right? And even, you know, whether it's they're doom scrolling at home, which is more exciting than actually going to a party. They're drinking less alcohol, which is probably a good thing, but also in the context of this conversation, they're missing out on experiences and fun and human connection and being a part of stories that real humans were there for. And people would rather stay home and disconnected and dirty talk on a, you know, dating app as opposed to actually go on the date and do the actions, you know?
It's so true. And now with live streaming, people are live streaming being an event. I used to always have this DJ. I used to watch his lives and I was like, yeah, like, I don't need to go to the club. Like this guy's DJing from TikTok. So even the live streams, like, hey guys, I'm going to take you to brunch with me, or I'm going to take you on this date. You're right. People aren't going out into the real world because they can do it all from their phone.
So at what point does vicarious experience become harmful?
Yes, and this parasocial relationship. At what point does it become harmful is, I think, how much impairment it has on your life. If you are becoming isolated, if your mood is low, if you're anxious, if going out freaks you out because you're not used to it, I think that's a really massive thing. I think a lot of people had social anxiety after lockdowns, but you need that balance. You need that. I know I'm guilty of that. Like, I go through stages where I don't, you know, go out much, and I like that because that's my lifestyle, but you have to. You have to go out and be with people and get connection. It is so important, Maddie. And I think you and I learned that, especially when I moved up here to Queensland. I'm like, I don't need friends. I don't need anybody. And then I started feeling really down. I'm like, what's wrong with me? Am I depressed? And then you realize, no, you just need someone to talk to other than your partner and your dog.
Well, and I don't know if this resonates with you, but, you know, both you and I are running our businesses from our laptop, right? And so the need to go out into the world, onto a train, to an office every day, sure, that's maybe mundane and boring and people hate it and they would wish they could quit their 9 to 5. But I have to now, even as a social extrovert that, you know, I feel amazing around people, I have to consciously be like, look at my calendar and be like, when am I leaving the house this week? Because I know from lockdowns, that I can end up in a really bad place in my head and, you know, be wondering, what's the point of existing? Because, you know, I'm sort of trapped in this bubble of online world, you know, podcasts and stuff like that. And, you know, you and I did our first couple of episodes in person, in an actual studio, hanging out together, right?
I remember those days.
Yeah, but pre-COVID, back in the days where hanging out in real life was, you know, normal. And so, you know, that human connection, that physical, being in the physical presence of humans, even if you don't know them, even if you're sitting in the corner of the cafe and you just say hi to the girl that asks you for your coffee, you know, that is really powerful in being able to say, oh, I'm an actual part of the human experience.
Yeah, it's so important and it makes such a difference to your life. And studies on happiness have showed that is connections. You know, I know people who are so wealthy, they're making so much money and they have no one to celebrate it with. And it's so sad because there's always that next thing they're chasing, that next goal, that next financial reward. And it's like, what's the point? Happiness is real when shared.
Oh, completely, completely. Which is why it sucks that you're in Queensland, because I'm having a huge party this week at my
house. Oh, are you? Maddie Lansdowne.
Next time you're down, we'll have another party just to say Steph's back.
What are you celebrating?
My birthday.
Happy birthday. When's your birthday?
The 8th of August. The 8th of the 8th. Lionsgate portal.
No way.
Yeah. It's a very abundant. I'm very lucky to have this date.
That's wild. You do give lion vibes.
Every part of my ego loves that you said that. So because we're talking about this relationship with social media and food validating unhelpful behaviors, like, where do we start? Like, is it regulating the dopamine we get from the phone? Is it regulating the dopamine we get from food? Like, is it just giving permission for it all to be okay? Like, where's step one?
Yeah, step one is recognizing that you have a problem with food. So even if you're working full time, if you are binging and purging and thinking about food 24/7, it is not normal. It is common, but it is not normal to be thinking about food all the time, to be hyperfixating on your next meal, to be watching videos of people eat all the time. So if this is you, know that your life doesn't have to be that way. But the most important thing is weight loss isn't going to fix your problem. I know people have such a strong desire to lose weight, but if you do not heal your relationship with food, you will never, ever feel good about your body, about your relationship with food. And yes, it's a process and it takes time. Mm-hmm. But if left unmanaged, life just is not enjoyable when you feel guilty about food all the time.
Oh my God, we're so aligned on all of that stuff in the work that we do, which I love. Question I've got though, because I think since we've last podcasted, I've done a bunch of, you know, sort of eating disorder training and binge and emotional eating disorder training as a practitioner, not to your level being a psychologist, but I've done a bunch of different things. And the narrative that I see, and I don't know where you sit with this, which is why I want to ask, the narrative that I see in this world is that never is weight loss okay. Never talk to a client, never talk to anybody about weight loss. And my thoughts are that I personally disagree with that because I think it's okay to want to be in a healthier body. But what are your thoughts on that idea?
Depends who you're working with. If someone is in an active eating disorder, they should not be trying to lose weight because trying to lose weight is what got them in the eating disorder in the first place. Whereas I think if someone has a genuine desire to work on, again, what does health mean to them? I think it's important to ask the person, what does health mean to you? What does a healthy relationship with food look like for you? I think it's important to discuss the question because if someone has a really strong desire to lose weight, but they're in an active eating disorder, you need to have that conversation and say, look, can we put that desire on the back burner and focus on your relationship with food? And I've had women break down and cry with relief because no one has said that to them before. No one has given them permission to not focus on weight gain, not focus on weight loss. And when I say, you don't need to lose weight right now, like let's put that desire on the back burner. Let's focus on healing your relationship with food. So yes, if you're doing specific eating disorder training, I agree that you don't want to focus on weight loss if someone's in an active eating disorder, but I think it's okay to understand and listen to their desires, but then use your strategies, use cognitive challenging and questioning to better understand and challenge those beliefs that reinforce the desire to lose weight. That's one part of it if you're working with an eating disorder population. If someone has a desire to, you know, work on their health, whatever that looks like for them, I think it's important to make sure they meet a certain criteria. You know, have they been eating disorder symptom free for at least a couple of years? Why do they want to lose weight? What is that about? And focus more on health related behaviors, such as joyful movement, such as eating in balance, eating regularly. Because when people eat intuitively, Maddie, their body will find its natural happy point, its happy medium. So yeah, I think it's okay to want that, but I think it depends on the stage that someone's in.
Yeah, I totally agree. And obviously everything we talk about is always personalized and contextualized by the individual in front of us. But I think the interesting thing is even putting it on the back burner, just as you said, you know, if you start developing a healthier relationship with food, your biology will naturally move towards its happy place anyway, which for many people that I work with, that process is exactly what happens when we do all the mindset, psychology, you know, emotional eating work. And people are like, oh, I noticed my dress feels a bit better
yes.
today.
Yes. Oh, I'm not bloated.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we haven't even talked nutrition at all by that point, right? And yeah, the body's just moving back to where it's naturally happy.
Yes, because the person isn't stressing. When you're stressed and worried about your weight, you're going to cause inflammation. You're going to cause, you know, activities that people take laxatives, people are purging. That leads to gastrointestinal distress that reinforces a bad body image. Whereas if you, and I love this term body respect, if you can respect your body, where it's at, if you can do exercise because you want to and not equate exercise with weight loss, if you can live as though you love and accept your body, then your body will change.
Yeah, I love that. Steph, this has been such a cool conversation. And obviously everybody who hasn't heard you before, if they did, it was a very long time ago. But where can everybody find you online? Where are they going?
Thanks, Maddie. This has been so good. I've loved all these twists and turns we've taken today. I am Mind Food Steph on social media. And if you're wanting to jump on a call to discuss your relationship with food, come and have a chat. It's such an important topic to discuss. But if you want to find me, I'm on TikTok and Instagram at MindFoodSteph.
Amazing. I will put that down in the caption or show notes below. So head down there and get in Steph's world. Steph's obviously awesome. She's been in my world for, I don't know, 6-7 years at this point, and I still think she's awesome. So get amongst it. But to wrap up, what is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about?
Hating your body doesn't change it. And dieting is the biggest predictor of future weight gain. So if you want to feel body peace, if you want to feel at ease with your relationship with food, focus on really cultivating self-compassion and taking it one step at a time. It's not easy, but it's definitely worth it.
Amazing. If I didn't need this mic, that would be a mic drop moment right there.
Drop.
Amazing. All right. Well, thanks so much for being here and I look forward to doing the next one. But for now, we'll catch you soon.
Thank you so much, Maddie. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.